Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. 3/23/23 for you nerds out there. I'm Jeff O'Neill here with Rebecca Shinsky coming to you from BookRiot.com. I've been recording all day, Rebecca, because we've got something new to talk about today.
We do indeed. You have secrets.
Well,
I guess secrets no more.
Not really anymore. So start a new podcast, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. It's called First Edition. I'm the producer. It's going to be a lot of different people. You were kind enough to be the first guest on Carson, so to speak, with the first segment. The first episode's coming out April 5th. You can go wherever you get your podcast, look for First Edition. You can see the trailer so you can subscribe and see a little more about it. I'm not sure how to frame this. I've had troubles from internally describing it. It's not this show, obviously. It's not news, but it's talking about books and bigger picture things. There's going to be a lot of interviews about publishing and the industry, what it means to be a reader, and all kinds of different stuff. The basic idea is there's a bunch of stuff out there that we could talk about with books in all different kinds of ways. And that's bigger than this show does. We are doing news. We're doing headlines. We're doing deep dives into TikTok sales. Just wait for that. That's coming up today. But there's another layer to this that can be interesting. And so just, I guess, as an example, the gimmick we came up with for your first appearance, and I think we'll do it regularly if we continue to do this show in the future, is try to figure out what the it book of the month is, right? So we've done some, we do fall preview dash for Patreon, you know, Liberty and her rotating cast does every week. It's both kind of too big and too small. And so this is a month where then we can talk about what books are coming out, compare them to each other. And then people from publishing, interviews with books that are coming out. I think you'll find, if you like this show, you should like that show. So that's coming out soon.
I think that's right. It's like a variety hour.
It's like a variety hour, yeah. And each show will have 2 to 3 to 4 segments, depending on the length. Should be about an hour, a little more than an hour. So you get a taste of different things. So if you don't like every segment, you know, you can skip ahead to do the next one. Though I hope every segment is interesting, even if it's not something you would sort of pick out of a lineup of your own volition. So that's April 5th coming out. Going to be every 2 weeks for a while. I just lined up a couple of really interesting things to do. I guess I'll say now, Vanessa Diaz and Kelly and I are going to talk about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, ahead of the movie coming out April 23rd. Maybe you and I will have a chance to talk about it after the movie comes out or something, but getting ready for that, but also to look back on that. I have in the can some interviews with authors already, some people in publishing. I'm really excited to do it, and I hope you'll give it a try. I have to say, after we got off our segment yesterday, we were both like, that was a lot of fun. And we always know there's something there when we say that.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun most of the time, but this was like extra a lot of fun. It was a really good idea, a fun idea, and something that we, like, as you were saying, similar to things we had done before, but not that exact shape. And it was just a blast. I was honored and delighted to be, you know, first in the seat on Carson.
And one of the things the Patreon's allowed us to do, shout out to Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast, is we played around with content. And I think we're coming up on a year of the Patreon being live. Thank you so much to everyone subscribing there. But you and I have played around with different formats, different ways of talking. And I think that really got me to think again. And I went back to my bear notes, Rebecca, and I had notes about something like this going back to 2015. So it's been percolating for a while of how to do this. But I think seeing how much fun we have with podcasting. Frankly, from the distribution point of view, there's something to podcasting that's different than doing web or other kinds of social or other social media things. So I'm looking forward to playing. So I have an idea to bring back some formats of long podcasts from long ago that Indiana Jones put into the warehouse with the Holy Grail, or excuse me, the Ark of the Covenant, and break some of those back out. I know some of you liked old annotateds and reading lives and recommended and even some get booked type things, but I think variety is the best way of thinking mm-hmm. about it. So,
I think so too.
There's going to be socials, there's a Twitter, there's an Instagram, there's an email, first edition at BookWriter. I'll put all that in the show notes. And I guess for those of you who's listening to this show and have been with us for a while, just that you know the show at all, you know us already a little bit, I really would love feedback. What segments you liked, what's interesting, you know, whatever else ideas you might have, because I'm trying to figure it out. Like, I want to make something people like, and I know that sounds dumb, but I think a lot of times people, when they try to make something, they make the thing they want to make. And sometimes that does or does not align with what sort of people want. And I've got some ideas, but they could all be bad. And I'm just excited to try something new, and we'll see. So I don't think it'll change anything here. I don't think we're going to keep doing our thing here. This is our steady drumbeat, our comfort animal here.
We're rolling up on our 10th anniversary.
I know. Have we talked about what we should do for that? I mean, we sort of, what should we do for our 10th anniversary? Is this a segment? Is this a show? Are we recording? What are we doing?
Sure, we are recording. Okay. We have not talked about what we should do for it. I don't know. One of the staff members was like, maybe go back and listen to the first episodes and talk about them live. And I was like, absolutely not.
Yeah, you could also break this coffee mug I have in front of me and eat it. You know, those are two things we could do.
Really wants to go back and hear themselves 10 years ago think out loud. No, thank you. We'll come up with some sort of nostalgia.
Or we'll give you some ideas. Maybe we'll talk about some ideas and we can take a vote or something like that. Well, let's do our first sponsor break. We got a couple other housekeeping things to do, but we're already getting long.
Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
Speaking of things you can sign up for, the deep dive, that's Book Riot's new Substack. There's a free version. It's a freemium, as all these Substacks are. And then if you want to kick in a few bucks, you can get all the sends to you. Rebecca wrote about reading goals, or maybe kind of reading goals, or yeah, you hear in my voice already. I wrote about the Colleen Hoover strangeness. Sharif has written about gardening. There's some nice stuff coming about tracking, I think, in the future. I know Vanessa's got one coming out. Danica's writing. So you can check that out. Deep dive. Link in the show notes there. We're also hiring a web developer. It's a full stack web developer. You can read more about what that is. The salaries posted, the jurisdictions, all this stuff. I think we're trying to do the best, the modern best practices for all the information into a job description. So go check all those things out in the Patreon itself. Links in the show notes, bookriot.com/listen, or in whatever podcast player you're probably playing from right now. Okay, I think that gets us into follow up. This one came across, well, meta point. So all the best practices for starting new podcasts right now are you got to have some soch, Rebecca. You got to have we don't do this.
Indeed
this is
do.
Only we talked about for this show. You and I are not heavy public soch users for reasons that I guess I don't feel like getting into right now. It's, we don't see the
there were consequences to being a woman who was a heavy public soch user, yeah. So I decided not to
be. Yeah, and even as not having that, I also had a couple experiences like, yeah, not so much for me right now. But having said that, it is a thing. Social media is a thing. Have you heard about this? And so I've been on literary Twitter a little bit. Some of it is to establish the first edition Twitter feed. Also, it's a good way to find people and what they're talking about and who's interested in what and making some connections. And so for good and for ill, I'm seeing a lot more of the discourse, which...
Go with God, my friend.
But one thing that did come to my attention that I wouldn't have seen, and I think it's worth mentioning here, if we hadn't talked about Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow in depth, and we did it part of the Patreon, I know it wasn't part of the show, but we've mentioned it here. I probably wouldn't talk about that. But since we did, and in the course of that discussion, I remember lauding Gabriel Zevin for not only having to write a good novel, but having to come up with a couple of interesting ideas for video games that her video game developers came up with.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the Signal one in the book that she uses that's written and created by this young female developer was actually based on on a game that was real, that was made by a woman named Brenda Romero.
Oh, cool.
And it was nowhere in the acknowledgments. And only because of Wired and New York Times pushing her did Zevin say, yes, it's that. And Brenda Romero, as you might understand, is upset. I think it would have been in the acknowledgments just saying, and the idea for this is based on X came from Y, come from Brenda Romero.
Yeah.
So, which is a bummer. And I thought, you know, Just to do the due diligence, whatever reparative work can be done of saying, I thought that was, I attributed to Zevin, it was her. I think from my point of view, again, I'm not an ethicist about this, acknowledgement saying this game or this representation of the game is based on the actual woman who actually wrote this game at this time. And it sounds like that's all, Romero would have been happy with that too. But in a book that is about women in video game development and erasure and not taking people seriously, the generous reading is a real bad oversight, and I don't even know what to say about what the non-generous reading is. I find it hard to believe that Zevin was intentionally not mentioning that A, just for reasons, and B, thought no one would notice eventually. I'm not sure what I think about it. So more of an informational than a bromide from me, but I thought I would get that out there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm stuck on the, this is new information for me. And I'm also stuck on the, like, if the game is even moderately well-known, you would assume that people would notice. And we do try to err on the side of the generous interpretation. Hopefully it was just a mistake, but that seems to me like kind of would be the equivalent of Tara Jenkins Reid in her debut novel, Daisy Jones and the Six, not acknowledging that it was inspired by Fleetwood Mac. Right. Like, come on. Yeah.
So maybe the paperback edition can do something about that. And, I don't have much else to say. It doesn't sound like it's a complicated story. It's a simple one, but doesn't mean it's great.
And I think there's nothing to be lost by citing your inspirations. It's good to give credit where it's due. And that's a 400 and some odd page work of creativity that mostly sprang whole out of Gabrielle Zevin's head. So it's like, it's all right to acknowledge that some of your ideas came from somewhere else. That's what we're all doing here, is learning from each other.
It sounds like the game has been out for a while, and it's very similar. It's written by one person, an indie project, and Romero kind of made her bones on it. And it's like, it sounds like, you know, we talk about writers. It sounds like it's a developer's game. You know, like if you know, cool situation in that community. So fascinating to see. Also, apparently Romero was on the way to GDC, which I think is the Games Developer Conference, and saw a bunch of people reading Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and being asked about it. Like, this sounds like your game. It's like, that sucks, man. That sucks so bad. I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah. That's not a great way to find out about that.
No. Very tough stuff. Got a lot more feedback about replacing words, lyrics, sentences, updating them. A lot of people give lyrics examples, and I have here, let's see what, too many to cite. I'm not going to go, there's a bunch. Okay. It happens. That's true.
Cool.
And then, you know, here's one. I think I'm still okay with my, if you're the artist, if that's your song and it represents the best of your understanding now, cool. That's great.
Yeah.
We learn things, we grow, we change. But if you're dead, it's hard to change. So I don't know what else to say. I still need some sort of paratextual citation or an appendix or something that this is not the original thing. That's me. I think you had mentioned this before, and someone brought this up in an email of, what about something? Here's another example that's maybe, I don't know, a different angle on. In the case of Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret by Judy Blume, swapping out the period products mentioned for more modern things. And I don't know what this belt and suspender situation is about that was in the original, but it's been swapped out. I understand with, you know, tampons and modern things you can go to the drugstore and find. Is there any, I don't know, Judy Blume's still alive. I'm going to assume for the moment she at least signed off on that. If she didn't, I don't care about this one so much.
It doesn't, when we're talking about, I don't think this doesn't change the substance or the meaning of the book at all. And updating the products allows the reader to have the intended experience, you know, to recognize themselves or to recognize an experience that they might have someday or that people that they know are going to have. Changing language, whether it's the author's own perspective or language that comes out of the mouths of characters, is that's a different situation. Like, are we updating because we've recognized that this is racist and we don't want to, like, we never wanted to use racist language, or leaving it, what does leaving it there mean about the work? What does changing it mean about the substance of the work? Like, I think it's totally possible you could take some books that were set in the early 90s, and if you wanted to update those for a contemporary audience, you could, you know, write in some iPhones and, you know, streaming stuff on Netflix instead of going to Blockbuster. And you wouldn't meaningfully change anything about the substance that's happening there. You would just be reaching a new audience and, you know, making it more accessible, making the story and the ideas more accessible for present day readers. I do think that's meaningfully different than changing language that conveys something about society, something about the author's perspective, something about an idea we're supposed to understand about a character. Like, Well, we talked about White Noise by Don DeLillo on the Patreon. And, you know, book came out in the 80s. The main character expresses a lot of opinions about a lot of things that are not the kinds of things that we would say are okay to put on paper in 2023. It does tell us really important information about that character, though. And the updated, the movie that came out last year, early this year, doesn't do really any of that character's internal monologue, but that means we also don't hear him say any of those things. And it doesn't, I don't know, I don't think it harmed the experience. We got the vibe from that film of what it was supposed to be about, but you do learn interesting things about that character because he's the kind of guy who comments on women's weight, you know? And if you just take those things out of a book, because it's not appropriate to comment on people's bodies anymore, but that's the kind of person who would do it, we are losing that information. And I think there's room, especially in the literary community, for nuance and for understanding that sometimes our characters are going to do things that aren't cool because people do things that aren't cool. And we need to be able to explore that in fiction and to understand that an author writing a character who does something like that is not the author condoning that behavior. And the it's the author's job in the broader work of the text to make that clear as well, to show us that there is some kind of critique or we're seeing this character do this thing for a reason. But, you know, updating period products, updating technology, I don't have an issue with that.
Yeah. So is the author part of the change? Does it represent their best current understanding? That's one, that's one sort of one gate to pass. And the other one, does it change the spirit of it? Right. Because really, I mean, it's almost, for me, more of a problem if changing, use doll for example, the language actually does change the spirit, right? That's actually meant to be fat phobic or, you know, whatever else it might be, to something else that make it more palatable now, but actually is not in the spirit of the original text. And again, attention must be paid to those changes, and I don't want them to be modern washed away without comment or without record. And without context, because those original representations matter. And there's other books out there.
The context is really important.
The context is really important. So, but it's a good example, right? I mean, it's an, it's a different kind of thing of what do you do about these texts that are published after the fact. And I, you know, as you all know, listening, that one of my favorite authors of all time is Whitman, and my favorite book is Leaves of Grass, which he wrote about 90 billion editions of, that went from like a 40-page chapbook to this giant monster by the 1898 deathbed edition. So I am not opposed to people changing and amending, but once that person is gone, we get into very treacherous territory about the truth that I think is important to keep in mind. Speaking of important, this is one of those things, like, it is true because it feels true. To quote Sleepless in Seattle, there are a lot of book bannings. And Rebecca, nearly doubled 2022 over 2021. And I wouldn't be shocked if 2023, we're still looking at a hockey stick here for 2023. I'm at a loss. I feel helpless. I'm at a loss. This next story about the U.S. House resolution will further ignite book bans. This is flipping bad, Rebecca. I don't know what to do about this. And there doesn't seem to be any sign of abating at this point.
I mean, we know the things to do about it, and they are slow-moving things that don't make nearly as splashy headlines as the stuff on the side of the book banning does. This, like, really fear-driven, closed-minded attempt to protect a way of life that's mostly white, that's mostly straight, we've said all the things that we can say about this over, you know, the last several years as this has been increasing. It felt degaslighting, ungaslighting, the anti-gaslighting to see these numbers. Spotlighting to it, affirming of like, yes, it does feel like there are so many of these and so many more of these than before, because there are so many more of them than before. And, you know, of these, like, doubling the title, double the challenges in 2022 over 2021, it was 2,571 unique titles that were targeted, which was a 38% increase of titles targeted for censorship. since 2021. As we have discussed endlessly here, the vast majority of those were by or about members of the LGBTQ community or people of color. The full annual ALA report is coming out in April, and I'm sure we'll have more to say about it then. But the things to do are to be, you know, writing your representatives, being politically engaged, and if you have the opportunity to run for a local position or support folks who run for local positions, it's paying attention to these local elections, because the folks who want to ban books are certainly paying attention to them. And we've got to make it harder, and we have to make it stop working for them as well. This continues to happen because it's an effective political strategy. It gains attention, it gets PR, it plays on parents' fears, parents of certain persuasions. And we have got to find ways to make this less effective and less sticky.
There's a quote here from Deborah Caldwell Stone that's talking about how this is both a difference in degree and kind. The kind difference here is the strategy. We're seeing these challenges come from organized censorship groups that target local library board meetings to demand removal of a long list of books they share on social media. So I guess I'd say, let's go back 3 years. We talk about a story like this. Usually it'd be some nutter that's like, I can't believe my son, Timmy, had to read a book where X happened. And it's like there's a name, and it's a specific, and it's at the Marion County Middle School, JFK local middle school, and it's like specific. This is
that woman in Northern Virginia waving a dildo school board meeting.
It's Field of Dreams steps aside, you singular Nazi cow, in this particular moment where this is organized, it's digital, and it's overwhelming. And they're trying to basically carpet bomb library board meetings with lists of books, knowing that it's easier. And I get it. On the whole, I certainly don't blame teachers and librarians for capitulating, because it's an asymmetric warfare that's happening on them. They do not have their jobs are on the line when this parent's job isn't. The parent job could go home, or this group, the Moms for Liberty can move on to the next town if it doesn't go well. You get fired, blacklisted, kicked out, removed, that's different for sticking up for a book or a list of books. So it's very difficult to do, and it's just an overwhelming number of challenges to strain the system and basically overrun, right, with superior numbers, and has found a weakness in basically our humanist discourse about reading and exposure to information, found a weakness in it, and then running right through it with a football team's worth of people. The 10 most challenged books list will come out on Monday, April 24th. I'm so much less interested in this than I would be some years, because the specific books don't matter. I mean, they do the kinds of books, but like these 10 don't matter. It's the whole system here. It's not an individual book. That matters a lot less in my mind than I used to feel like it mattered, though I want to know, but I think it's going to be the trends. Like you said, it's going to be LGBTQ and stuff about racism and American history not being squeaky clean. That's what it's going to be. I mean, that's what it is.
It's so overt. Yep. You know, it's never been subtle, but it has not always been as overt as it is what these groups are trying to do. You know, we had video of folks at the CPAC conference a couple of weeks ago talking about how their goal is to legislate trans people out of public life. And this is part of that. It's all about control. And this is one of the vectors, and it's one of the most powerful vectors that they have, by preying on people's fears about what will happen, what will be done to their kids. And I guess to pivot us to the next point, the next piece in our agenda, Kelly Jensen, who's done, just as we've said, incredible coverage of censorship attempts over the last few years for us at Book Riot, has a piece about a new House resolution in the U.S. House. So at the national level, it's been introduced by Julia Letlow, who's a Republican representative from Louisiana. It's called H.R. 5, and it is a parental rights bill. It has over 70 co-sponsors. All of them are Republican. The bill is going to be voted on sometime in this next week, and it purports to give parents rights that they already have. Or as Kelly puts it, it blatantly overlooks the fact that parents have always had rights when it comes to their children's education. Parental rights have been a popular talking point among right-wing politicians and quote-unquote grassroots groups like Moms for Liberty and No Left Turn in Education. This purposeful misnomer suggests parents have not been allowed to have a say in what their children learn or what their children learn or where they learn. However, parents have always had rights. And then she goes on to point out that the greatest risk to children's lives, school-age children's lives in the U.S. is gun violence. It's not drag queens. It's not books by gay people. And this is also a just hugely and upsettingly successful tactic for redirecting the conversation away from those things, away from gun control, which folks on the far right, you know, are not in favor of, away from talking about the things that do make our society very dangerous for children, and putting focus on individuals who are just trying to live their lives and be free and be able to be themselves in public in a society that has freedom of speech and freedom of expression, rather than really, you know, going into addressing those core problems, because to address those core problems would necessitate removing power and removing some of, you know, these ideas that these folks are putting forth from our national stage. And there's, it's all tangled. If it feels all tangled up together, it's also because it is all, tangled up together.
Yeah. So there you go. Link in the show notes there. Boy, where are we going to go next? It's all over the place. I guess in the distribution, what is in books, how they get distributed. The latest episode in my least favorite publishing story, well, it's up there, is a book with some dangerous, harmful crap in it being distributed by a major publisher. So this is a title being distributed by Skyhorse, which will distribute anything, you know, whatever. That's, or will publish anything, published by Skyhorse, and then distributed by SNS. So what distributed means is like basically using the warehouse, using the trucks, using the boxes, using the Edelweiss gallery, some, or the catalog, just to put it in there. And it sounds like a pretty nasty book. Freedom of speech, blah, blah, blah. You know, you can publish stuff like this if you want to. The question is, what kind of any pressure to put on SNS not to do it? What kind of responsibility to have for merely distributing a book? I guess I have less of an opinion about this. I don't really know. I feel like it's more on the, I'm not really sure what to say. I mean, are you culpable? Maybe you're taking the few percentage points. You're taking the money from Skyhorse to distribute their stuff. And one of the things they do is this pretty bad sounding book that is not illegal. But it's very bad, I would say. And most people, I'm sure, that work at SNS would probably prefer that it doesn't exist in the world. And this is to the point we've made before about, as we know more and we pay more attention to how these things get into the world, people are trying to figure out where to put pressure, where it makes sense, internally and externally, for these companies to do things that they've done for a very long time. So there's a story there, and you can see what's going on there, because really what SNS would probably have to do is sever the relationship with Skyhorse, right? Or they're going to be on the hook for everything they distribute. So it's really kind of calling into question the distribution model that these publishers have, because I'm sure a lot of these, I mean, PRH, all of the big five are distributing all kinds of smaller presses that on the whole tend to do stranger things, right? I mean, I think that's fair to say.
They do.
So I can certainly see their problem, but maybe it's the juice isn't worth the squeeze for them to be distributing Skyhorse and other people like this right now. Don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. It'll be interesting to see if anything comes of it. I don't expect that anything will come of it. I would hope that folks at the big houses are having a conversation about whether the juice is worth the squeeze, you know, like, it's not Simon and Schuster offering an author money for this book, but as you were saying, Simon and Schuster is making some money off of it. Is that money worth knowing that you have been part of the chain that puts this harmful material into the world? And what kind of, I think it's part of a bigger conversation that publishing is very slowly coming around to having about what is the responsibility of a publisher and what is the difference between freedom of speech and like curation that these private businesses in publishing perform when they decide what to publish and what not to publish, what to distribute right. and what not to distribute, in the same way that we've had the conversation around like Facebook wanting to say they're not a publisher, they're just a platform, therefore they shouldn't be responsible for harmful things that are disseminated on their platform or any of the harmful actions mm-hmm. that are taken in response to that material. That doesn't feel right. Yeah. It doesn't feel true. You're enabling something. And I would like to see publishing take a hard look at that and make some decisions about it. These one-off cases, I think, are must be very difficult if you're inside yeah. Simon & Schuster to solve, because you know that there's going to be another one. So what right. do you do? Do you Skyhorse? This is the story mm-hmm. about Skyhorse.
Woody Allen, took that book from Hachette.
Right. Like, this is what this does. And not for nothing, the big houses themselves mostly have imprints that do this kind of yeah, stuff too. Right. Like, there's a really gross right-wing imprint at PRH, and there's one at HarperCollins, you know, like this happens. How gross they are is on the spectrum, but it's out there. And it's just like, if you're trying to decide the one-offs, it must be, well, do we just sever the relationship entirely because this is just going to keep happening? And that, you know, if people make enough noise about it, they could make it worth it for them to sever it. Or do you like have someone on staff now whose job is to review every title from every publisher that you distribute and determine which ones you won't distribute? And maybe that's a way to do it, but I haven't seen anybody develop that yet. What kind of scrutiny are you applying to works that you aren't publishing, but that you are aiding in getting out into the world?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just because you can say anything doesn't mean you should say anything. And
right.
you know, you should make a decision. If you don't believe in this stuff, then think about how you shouldn't do it. And it's a legacy of an unscrutinized publishing ecosystem, this kind of book. So I think that's what
I'm there. I think an interesting counter example, or maybe just tangential, that I am thinking about, because I heard James Daunt on the Decoder podcast with Nilay Patel recently. Really interesting, like, hour-long interview talking about how he has turned Barnes & Noble around. And Nilay Patel just goes right in at one point of like, you know, how are you handling this stuff with book banning? And, you know, Barnes & Noble stores have been targeted. Right. How are you handling the way that, you know, sort of public opinion has turned on J.K. Rowling? Would you remove Harry Potter books from your shelves? And he says, you know, we have not yet made the decision to remove an author's books from our shelves because of that author's expressed opinions in public. But we wouldn't hesitate to remove books where the book itself is harmful. Like, we would not carry, and he just outright says, we would not carry a book that is about Holocaust denialism. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not in line with our values. We would not stock it. Or if it made it onto the shelves, we would remove it from the shelves. And that kind of clarity from someone running a giant company like that, who just outright said it, is something I'd like more of and that I don't hear very often. So that was interesting. Like, Simon, that's a model that Simon & Schuster could follow. Yeah. Here are our values. We're not going to apply them in this way. We're going to apply them in this other way. Here's what that means about Skyhorse titles.
Yeah. And you're going to have to scan after the fact, because no one at Barnes & Noble can read all the books can't happen.
Right.
It's not going to happen. I don't think it's reasonable to expect it to happen, but maybe if someone brings up something to you, you can mm-hmm. whack that mole once it pops its head up, mm-hmm. And be responsible in a way that's sustainable, in the long term. Yeah. I mean, the continuing reckoning with the overt and public, and even if it's public, even within the organizations, remembrance/realization that all this stuff is political. That there is no perch you can alight to that gets you above the political fray and say, we just publish books, man.
And also, not for nothing, the publishers are receiving pressure for this, in large part in response to the fact that after the death of George Floyd and mm-hmm. over the last few years, as gay and trans rights have been attacked, publishers have come out saying, yep. we support, you know, Black Lives Matter. We believe in inclusivity. We want to represent people of all genders and identities and experiences. We want to publish books about those people in their lives. We want to hire gay and queer and people of color. And you cannot talk, you can't say that out of one side of your mouth and then also publish or distribute a book about AIDS denialism and expect not to be, you know, held to it. There's some, you know, apparent hypocrisy that's going on there. And I think that's a real place where publishing could take a hard look at itself. You hopefully we're hearing publishers express these values because those are genuine values to them. And from the folks we know in publishing, I believe that's true. I think most folks working in books tend towards a more liberal attitude and they do support those values, and publishers want that, want to go in that direction. That's wonderful. It's also really good for business to say those things. Mm-hmm. They've also gotten a lot of pressure from their employees mm-hmm. to say those things. So maybe there's some motivated reasoning to do that so you don't lose right. a bunch of staff members. But if you're going to come out and make those kinds of public statements, you have to back them up with your behavior. And it's reasonable for your public, your customers, and your staff to expect those statements to be backed up. So I think really the part of this that I'm the most over is that, like, in this case, Simon and Schuster, but it'll be another publisher next quarter. They always seem like a little bit baffled yeah. by how this happens. Like, don't they just understand that people can write books and we can distribute them? And it's like, you are in this position because you put yourself in this mm-hmm. position, friend. Yeah. Like, you cannot benefit from supporting inclusivity while also benefiting and profiting from something that's harmful to those same communities.
Well, you can. It's just you should expect people to say, wait a minute.
Right. I mean, exactly. They're trying to, and it's not going very well.
We'll see. You know, these things tend to blow over for rightly or wrongly. You know, I'm in 6 days, mm-hmm. will this still be a story? Will anything change? I don't know.
Yeah.
Speaking of things that will be a story, and we're seeing all how the water getting poured onto the concrete of ChatGPT is finding all the cracks in all kinds of things, but especially into the world of books and reading and writing and language. Two notable things. One you found was there are now more than, I'm sure today there's even more, right? More than 200 books mm-hmm. are available on Amazon that are expressly written by ChatGPT. Submitted by someone specifically. It doesn't look like Amazon has a position yet. I wonder if they're going to think about this soon. I don't know how they'll police it, but sometimes just putting that mm-hmm. ADT sticker on the window will prevent people from coming in, even if you don't have the system set up. You note that there are 2 million self-published books produced each year. So as a percentage, I mean, some infinities are bigger than others. I feel like 2 million self-published books is already infinity books. So, no, I'm serious. Like, right. if we add another 200,000, I mean, okay, it's infinity plus two. I don't know. I don't know how to do this.
Well, yeah, I think I was thinking about the sky is falling kind mm-hmm. of fears that we've seen expressed about ChatGPT. And like, now that this is out there, all of the online marketplaces are just going to be overrun right. by, you know, AI written books. And that's going to crowd out the real art. And like, that same fear existed about self-publishing. Mm-hmm. And there are 2 million self-published books.
That same fear was about the printing press with Gutenberg. It's like, now everyone right. can print a book.
Right. And there are two, we've gotten to the place where 2 million self-published books per
I'm, like,
year.
I'm sweating and, just looking at that. Like,
and those have, they have not successfully crowded out the real art.
Yeah.
You know, and the real art makes itself known, which is, again, I feel like we have to do all the same caveats every time we talk about mm-hmm. ChatGPT because it's so early still. But the fact that, like, this ChatGPT has been out for several months, that there are only 200, tells me something. There's a note in here, one of the a guy named Brett Schickler, who's a salesman in Rochester, New York. He gave prompts to ChatGPT to write a 30-page illustrated children's book he had never written before. He's only made about $100 yeah. through the sales so far, and he is still saying, though, like, but I could see people making a whole career out of this. Those two things contradict each other. You have made $100 out of it. But why do you think this is going to be a successful avenue? Someone is going to be successful at it in the same way that a handful of someones have been bonkers successful in self-publishing. Yeah. It will happen. I just continue to think those will be the outliers. And it was, you know, it made me feel more sane to see, like, only 200 of these are out there so far. Granted, probably folks are using ChatGPT and not acknowledging it. And Brett Schickler is one of those. It notes here that he doesn't list ChatGPT as a co-author of his book, but he was happy to talk to the Inside Hook and to acknowledge it. So there's probably more than that. But like, this is not yet overrunning at least the mainstream marketplaces. Like, I have heard that ChatGPT and AI written pieces are overrunning maybe some of the online communities that do genre fiction or fan fiction, sci-fi stuff. It's unfortunate that that's happening. And this is just a technology that we're going to have to, like, this is here. We're just going to have to grapple with it. And looking at the numbers was really helpful for me. Like, all right, we get 2 million of these a year. We've had self-publishing for about 10 years now in a meaningful way. You can still go online and find your way to a good book about the thing you want to read about without having to wade through pages and pages and pages of self-published stuff. And that's not to say that all self-published stuff is bad, but I'm just using the most recent example of the evolution in technology that we thought was going to ruin art. It did not. I think at least so far, we're seeing the same thing with ChatGPT. And it's definitely not like the trajectory of like this will immediately take over everything.
I was talking to Alex, who's our developer here at Book Riot, about ChatGPT, and we were talking, and it occurred to me, I was talking to him, you know, one use case that I do find exciting. So Vanessa and I were talking the first time with ChatGPT came up on this show was with Vanessa, and we were talking about that Clark's World being overrun. So having a hard time coming up with interesting use cases on the reader side. There's use cases on the backside of the publication and production of books that I do believe. And one of those that kind of meets in the middle is translation. Getting books in translation is really hard. Translation is expensive. Books in translation tend not to sell very well. So the return on investment tends to be pretty low. So it tends not to be much investment. And one thing these large language models are doing better than the transcription and language, you know, remember Google Translate when that first came out, it kind of seemed like magic, but it couldn't do what, and Alex used the term of art they use in game development, which I guess is called localization. So it's not just the literal translation, but they're translating the meaning and localizing it to a similar meaning in the idiom. So to use an example in English, we say something like a stitch in time saves nine. If you don't have that idiom in Japanese, a direct translation to that is gibberish, right? Right. So, and that's where the real art of translation can happen. And these large language models may be able to do that better. They may be able to have data sets. Does that crowd out translators? I don't know. Maybe it does, which I'd be sorry about. Would it potentially make a lot more books available around the globe in languages that the books would not exist in? Maybe. And that could be a real kind of silver lining.
It's fascinating.
A different kind of accessibility that we're talking about, accessibility in different terms we didn't think of, but that'll be an interesting one to see. Now, who gets the credit for the translation? I guess that goes to our next story. The WGA, the Writers Guild of America, is proposing to allow the use of ChatGPT in scripts as long as it doesn't impact author credential and residuals. Basically, we want some human to get paid, to get credit and get paid when this stuff gets made. We don't want this to be a situation where the robot comes and writes Mission Impossible 9 and there is no money given to a human for a story, whatever else that might be. I think this is, to me, probably dealing with the truth is that some of this is going to be used for some of this crap. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean all the stuff that goes into making anything that has words, people are going to find a way to use ChatGPT, or you should assume that to be the case. So rather than swallow the thing whole or bury your head in the sand, what kind of terms can you come up with now? That will protect, offer, cultivate, you know, sustain the creative work of humans when it comes to really anything at this point. I thought that was an interesting compromise to see there.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting as well. And like the only proposed policy of its kind that isn't so that I've seen from any, you know, creative guild in any of the creative media that wasn't like, let's just outright ban this.
It's not going to work, Rebecca. They shouldn't.
It's not going to work. It's not going to work.
It's not going to work. It's not going to work. Let's do our second sponsor break and do a couple other things.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy.
During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away With Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of. And bonus points because it's Finnish. And when's the last time you read a Finnish dystopian science fiction novel? Right. Okay. So in this one, humanity is destroying itself as the cities burn, which sounds kind of familiar. It is the time of the great affliction. In this terrible world, a new hope arises. The Happiness Program, which is the creation of a Finnish pharmaceutical genius, Dr. Laura Solomon. With happiness, pills, mind mapping, and microchips, Dr. Solomon intends to build a new world for the worthy few. Which sounds like a perfect plan and nothing could go wrong, right? Right. So this is a raw but fun dystopian sci-fi adventure with an unusual premise describing what happens when technology rules humanity. Either you're chipped living inside the AR society or you're left outside to barely survive. Make sure to check out Unchipped by Taya DeVere. And thanks again to Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you probably never heard of, for sponsoring this episode.
Constance Grady at Vox has a really good piece about the money of book talk, and not just sales, though I think that's kind of implicit here, but the book talkers, the influencers, the content creators who have sizable audiences and make money or can make money. And she gives some examples. And I think for me, it's the data is the most interesting piece is how much do you get for what? So I don't know. Where do you want to go with this? It's a long piece. Read it. We're not going to do the whole thing because it's worth reading. I'll put the link in the show notes.
I was also interested in the how much do you get for what, and it ranges. There are folks talking about, you know, a book company offered me $100 for a video and they would control all of the rights to everything forever. And then there are folks who make $2,000 per video to promote their book. And listening or reading these folks talking, the book talkers talking about that they're, you know, doing this labor, they're making this stuff, they want to benefit from it, and be paid for their work. And they're struggling with how do you do that in an authentic way? And so, like, the thing you have to say if you're an influencer in this situation is, I would only ever take money to promote a book or a product that I genuinely do like. I would never take money to promote something that I wouldn't, you know, genuinely endorse. And I hope that that's true. I believe it's true for most people, but that's the struggle for yourself. And how do your viewers know that the review you're giving is authentic if you were paid to give it? Would you have chosen that book to talk about if you weren't getting paid to talk about that book, or would you have chosen something else? Would you have said the words you said about that book in the way that you said them if you weren't getting paid? And this is, like, it's not special to TikTok, though. This is the core question about all sponsored content everywhere when you're talking about a sponsored review or sponsored placement in this way. And so it's interesting to see the book talkers, like, really dive into that. The way that they have framed it of, I want to get paid for my labor, is an interesting evolution to me. Because when we saw, like, when blogging came up, then when YouTube was the next thing and folks were realizing you could run ads on your blogs, you could take ads or do sponsored stuff on YouTube, the discourse was more like, it's nice that I can make some money off of this hobby of mine. The phrasing, and this might be elder millennial stuff, so I want to own that, but, like, the phrasing of, like, I want to be paid for my labor, as if you are being asked to do it for free by the publishers, is, I think, a tricky space to be in. And I'd like a little bit more scrutiny and conversation around that. Like, nobody's making you get on TikTok. No. Nobody's making you talk about particular books. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to create content anywhere. If you are choosing to create it, you are functionally creating free advertisements for the makers of whatever the thing is that you're talking about. they don't owe you anything for that. You've chosen to do it. And watching the like the tension that develops between the creators on one side saying like, I want publishers to pay me for this labor that I'm doing for them, but that originally they never asked me to do. And then marketers wanting to find, you know, effective ways to co-opt that audience and get the message out that they want. It's just kind of fascinating. Yeah. I think that's the most interesting part of it to me, because at least, you know, when we started blogging, it was very clear, like, nobody's making me do this.
There were some burbles of like, book bloggers do so much for the industry, shouldn't we get some of the money? Which, okay, but no one asked you to. What are the terms right. would be? When you get money for labor, there's stipulations that come along with it. And I think that's yes. one piece that mm-hmm. I think these creators that are mentioned here are very wise and they're right to notice is mm-hmm. I'm giving up something for that money. If I'm taking $2,000 for a video, I'm giving up something, even if it's just for that video, which is I can't say whatever I want. Right. The stipulation that I have to read the book. Well, that's one book I have to read versus what I'm going to do otherwise. It changes something. I got to put a hashtag in there, explain to my audience. Mm-hmm. Will they see me different? And you're basically trading a little piece of authenticity for some cash. And hey, listen, we run that's a book website and other things. We trade often. We don't do it like this, though, where it's you out there talking about the book and, you know, in your jeans and doing a dance and, you know, walking along, drinking a latte, talking about what you like, the Emily Henry book or whatever. We'll read a podcast ad, but it's more clearly defined as advertising. And this is the murky middle. And it's hard for both marketers and these. And there's, I also should mention, there's something about books, too, that people are more, there's more squeamish about it. And I don't know if it's right or wrong. They just are. Than if it's, I don't know, lip gloss or vitamin water. No, they just are, Rebecca. It's just a different, it feels true. Like it's different true. Somehow.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it just is.
Well, yeah, I think it's always helpful to pull the example out of the book thing yes. that has so much vocational awe right. and take it to, let's go with lip gloss in this example. Like, if I want to go on my Instagram and tell people how much I love Burt's Bees, am I like really helping out Burt's Bees and therefore I deserve a cut?
I mean, it depends. I mean, how many people had forgotten about Burt's Bees until your 500,000 TikTok folks saw it? I mean, you know, it's just exposure or something like that. But like mm-hmm. something about a book is like more of your identity is imbued, or you do some sort of like identity or sensibility transaction when you recommend a book. You just do in a way that you don't really think about when you're saying I like Coke yeah. better than Pepsi. And it's just different.
And I think so much of this is actually not even about the problem of social media, but about the problem that social media introduces yes. to us of turning yes. your avocation and your hobby into a side hustle. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fine to just be a person who likes books and has that as a core piece of your identity and that you want to talk about them with a community in some fashion. It's also fine if you want to build a big audience and get paid to talk about books to that big audience. But the ways that those lines get blurred of like, I started off as a person who was just talking to my community, mm-hmm. and now I feel like I deserve to be paid for doing that is, I think that's a tricky situation. If somebody comes and recognizes value in your community and they want to offer you money to, you know, create sponsored content or do whatever, like more power to yeah. you, make those decisions and see how it goes. It certainly works out for some people, but the starting off of a hobby and then the expectation that at some point, if you're good at the hobby, the industry that hobby lives inside owes you something.
And the industry is going to knock on your, hello, right. It's the industry. We owe you right. a check. You've been doing such good work for us.
Right. Like that's, I understand why readers feel like they do so much for the industry. And this does get also tangly because you get authors on social media begging readers yeah. to like, please leave me a Goodreads review. Please help me. Like there are benefits to the industry of passionate readers feeling like they are helpful and feeling like they are part of the industry. But I think that just on a scale writ large, what's happening is that a lot of readers on social media have like what's functionally a parasocial relationship to the publishing mm-hmm. industry, and they think that they have a relationship.
Yeah, and I didn't get this in time for the mm-hmm. show notes, but there was a piece on the bookseller about Nielsen did a study about how trying to quantify TikTok's influence on direct book sales, and they call it relatively small. Maybe I'll save this for another time. And I've got some We haven't, you know, we need to sweep out methodology corner. We haven't gotten to
see. We do.
But this one is maybe a good candidate. Maybe we'll look at it for next time. And I wonder how many books it actually moves. I know it moves some. How to quantify, that's very difficult. I think Nielsen has done some interesting extrapolations. Maybe I buy them, maybe they don't. But I think what I would say is I would guess that this is hard to quantify, and social media tends to be like that. Not for nothing, books present from a marketing point of view, and that by marketing I mean advertising, a unique problem is that there's a lot of books, Rebecca, and most of them don't have too much money. So right. An individual, a $500 sponsorship for an influencer with a bunch of strings attached is very hard for a publisher to sustain. They're getting $2,000 to review a book. I was like, that's incredible. That's an incredible amount of money in our industry.
That is incredible. And there are just not that many books, as you're saying, that have that much money available to throw in so many directions. Like, it's not uncommon for a debut novel to have a marketing budget of $5,000.
Or less.
Right. There's a lot of them that have zero. Right. But, like, you're going to spend or expect a publisher to spend $2,000 out of their maybe $5,000 on a sponsored TikTok video. Those are outliers. That's an outlier story.
Yeah. I'm glad Constance did this. I'm glad to see it there.
Really interesting.
It's probably what I expected. I guess I know nothing surprising to me. It feels almost like I would expect. There wasn't a lot of surprise, but it's nice to see it laid out. Kind of like the book banning thing, even if the story is happier here. I should also say, anyone who's doing this and making a hustle out of this and you're happy with it, it's cool, man.
Yeah,
we did this.
Go to town.
We've done this in a different format. So I completely sympathize, empathize, idealize, and rationalize a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing here, and I can see it at this point from so many different angles than I did, you know, 10 years ago or 11 years ago when I started this. I think we better kick Frontlist Foyer down the. We'll do a double shelf next week, unless there's something you need to get off your chest before we go.
Oh no, right. We can save it. Yeah. We'll just double up.
Books are there for you. They're waiting. They're not going anywhere. as always, you can find show notes, bookriot.com/listen. You can shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Go subscribe to First Edition, wherever you get your podcasts. And The Deep Dive, wherever you get your newsletters, which is actually not how Substack works. You have to go to a website to get your newsletters.
But you can read it wherever you get your email.
Yeah, or in your RSS reader. Which is, that's an elder millennial. I don't even know that. That's like a boomer. RSS, getting emails in the form of RSS readers like I do for some Substacks is, I'm not even sure.
It's a move.
That is. Yeah, that's
a move.
That's like building model train sets.
It's a thing you just confessed to the internet.
Well, you know, it has its utility. Rebecca, we'll talk to you next time.